Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, March 24th. A lot of rain here in Dallas today, but that's probably good. We always need the rain. That's one thing about Texas. We never complain about the rain unless it comes in storms like and shuts down all the traffic. But other than that, we can always use the rain. Today, we're going to be chatting with our friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at The American Thinker. Of course, Richard is also a columnist, writes a great deal about Israeli issues. And today we'll be getting a sense of what's going on in the country, the news of the day, as I like to say. We'll be talking about Obamacare and the GOP. These allegations by Representative Nunes, confusing, I have to say. I'm really confused by exactly what is the allegation. But I'm even more confused when you hear the Democrats, like Adam Schiff, talking about it. We'll talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, the hearings, that is. It's turning out to be, I used to say that these were like the Twilight Zone, but it's really more like a bad comedy. At least the Twilight Zone was a good show, but this is just a bad comedy, what we saw in these hearings. And then we'll hear what Richard has to say about Team USA and the WBC. So let's say hello to our friend Richard Baer up in the Windy City. How are you, Richard?
Actually, today you get rain. We have 75 degrees, and it'll be here for one day.
So what happens after?
It'll be where it was yesterday, about 40.
So, okay. So you got your global warming Friday for this week, I guess,
yeah,
right?
That's right. Global warming Friday. I like that.
You like that, global warming Friday. Well, you know, they have something for everybody these days, so why not call it global warming Friday? But a lot of crazy stuff going on in our politics, so let me just ask you for a quick reaction to the WBC. I had never, the baseball tournament, that is, I had never really paid much attention to it before. This year I got into it a little bit more, I guess, because of Team USA, and they ended up winning. But did you get excited about it this year? Did you pay more attention to it this year? Based on the ratings, I guess a few more people did this year, Richard.
Yeah, no, I think it was it's an interesting tournament, and it's, you know, unlike the Olympics, which is, you know, every 4 years. This is a different year where you don't have that kind of international competition during the summer. It is an odd time to do it. If you're going to have professional ball players, you're having them sort of leave their teams for a couple of weeks, a month, you know, during the month before the baseball season starts. But, you know, there was some unusual stuff going on. A team from Israel, which never fielded a team before. And of course, all the players are American other than two, I think. And they got to the semifinal round and beat international powers like Korea and Taiwan and the Netherlands and Cuba before fading a little bit at the end and getting knocked out by Japan. But and the U.S. team has sort of hung on, and when it came to the last couple games, got hot. And I think, as we talked about a little bit earlier, good pitching probably helped them. But I think there was, you know, there was more interest. And maybe because it's during spring training, that worked to benefit it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I do think the fact that the Team USA was winning probably created more following. For example, the final game against Puerto Rico was on ESPN Radio, which they had never been on ESPN Radio before, only on MLB, MLB Radio or MLB.com. But, you know, the most interesting thing about it, I guess, for me is that, well, I was happy to see the USA team win, of course, but I thought it was very interesting what happened with Cuba, because the Cuban team is really getting a lesson on what it's like to play professional versus junior college teams, which is what they used to play before when they had these Pan American games and so on. The American guys, or even the guys from Dominican or Puerto Rico or Venezuela, were basically junior college kids or baseball, you know, baseball academies kind of guys. But now they're facing major league pitching, and the Cuban team really looked awfully bad. in the tournament this year.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think they just got a big lesson on what professional pitching looks like, which is something
of course,
they don't get to see a great deal.
Some of the Cubans who have now played on American teams might have feared if they went to play for the Cuban teams, they would simply be put under lock and key and brought back to Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. I think they would have been a much better team, of course, if they had some of these Cuban players. But unfortunately, the politics gets involved. Well, let's talk about the politics up here. And I wanted to begin with Obamacare and the GOP. This afternoon, sometime after our show, there's going to be a vote. I think it says 2:30 p.m. Central Time. I have a funny feeling. I think it's going to pass by a vote because this is what I'm hoping also, that it passes even by one vote. Not because I think this is a perfect bill, but because I like to see Donald Trump spin it as a victory for him and the GOP rather than have to answer questions from the media as to how divided the GOP is. I mean, to me, this is more symbolic now than anything else, Richard.
Yeah, no. First of all, because it doesn't end here. It has to go to the Senate. It's not clear how much of the House bill can be approved in the Senate under the budget reconciliation rules, which only require a majority of senators, and how much of it is subject to filibuster, which means that it has no chance of being passed. So, I mean, this is sort of gamesmanship at this point, and having a defeat on the front end after Trump has invested time and a lot of energy trying to get, knock heads together and get these people to compromise a little bit would be seen as a disaster for him. And you look at this poll ratings, he was between 53 and 55% approval in the Rasmussen poll, which comes out every single day other than, I think, one weekend day. And now he's at 44%. So that's a pretty dramatic shift. And it's occurring because people are reading scare stories that they're going to lose their coverage, that they're going to be driven off of Medicaid, that rich people are going to get a tax break, and it's going to cut the benefits for those who already have them. And that's, from my judgment anyway, and I've been in this industry for a long time, the biggest problem the Republicans have with this is they are unified that they want to get rid of Obamacare. Some Republicans think that some of the features are very popular, and they are, such as parents keeping kids on their on insurance till age 26, the fact that insurance companies can't deny you coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Those are probably the two most popular provisions. The least popular is the individual mandate. So what you have right now is a battle that appears, the way it's being shaped, is that the Republicans are taking something away. This is very different than in 2009, where the debate was over something the Democrats wanted to add. Then the Republicans were arguing it's too expensive, it's a giveaway, it cuts down on our freedom, it gives control of health care to federal bureaucrats and takes it away from doctors. All those were good arguments, but once it passed, and all on Democratic votes, it created a new entitlement, a new Medicaid expansion entitlement, and a new entitlement for those people buying coverage on the exchanges with a federal subsidy. Republican position is a lot more dangerous because it looks like what they're doing is not starting from scratch and coming up with a new plan that may insure some people and maybe do it in a better way than the Democrats did. They're replacing something that already is providing coverage to people. And that is fraught with risk if at the end of the day or the day when the bill, transitions into a period where the new rules are in effect, and if 20 million people or 25 million people lose coverage, that's disastrous. I think those CBO numbers are out of line. I've actually talked to an actuary and who evaluated them, and some of them make no sense whatsoever. I don't think the bill will drive that many people away. But right now, I agree with you. The best thing to do would be to move it on, give the Senate, which doesn't have any time restrictions, the ability to look at this, rationally, and make adjustments, some of which may be things that will please conservatives, others that will please moderates and House members maybe in suburban districts. But there really needs to be modifications on both ends to make this, I think, better than what it is now.
Yeah. Well, I just think that from my point of view, I'm looking at what happens after the vote. If there's a yes vote, then President Trump will come out and say, we're on our way to repealing this thing. It'll be that type of spin. If there is a defeat, then the Democrats are going to say, well, the Republicans are not united. and so on and so on. So it seems to me at this point that it's really about a symbolic victory at this point.
Yeah, short-term politics.
The people, right. Yeah, the people who don't like it, they're still going to get a chance. I mean, the way it would work, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way it would work, it goes to the Senate where they're going to have their own show and they're going to have their own debate, and eventually something will come up there. And then it'll go to a conference, right, where they're going to argue about it forever, and then something will be voted on in both houses, right? There will be another vote in the House and another vote in the Senate, and that's what the final product is going to be. So the final product is still probably several steps away, and at this point, if I was a member of the Freedom Group or the right-wing group or whatever the name of the group is, Rush Limbaugh was joking about this, saying that the Republicans have all these groups, you know, the Friday group, the Tuesday group. So whatever the group that doesn't like this, I would give the benefit of the doubt to the president at this point and say we'll come back later. Because they're not really signing the deal here. They're simply moving the ball forward. And I just look at the symbolism of all of this. A defeat, I think, would be really bad for the GOP and for President Trump. So I'm hoping that two-thirds.
One of the big debates, and it really does affect, I think, what is in the House bill and what's in the Senate bill, is this arcane Senate rule for budget reconciliation. In essence, generally you need 60 votes at this point for anything in the Senate other than cabinet members and lower court judges. And a budget reconciliation allows something to be replaced, changed, with 51 votes, so long as all the provisions that are in the replacement bill deal with matters of either spending or taxes, not incidentally, but essentially in a major fashion. That's what they're about. The Republicans have been gun-shy. You know, think of what the Democrats did when Obama was ticked off Republicans wouldn't approve his judges. They used the nuclear option and changed the rules so they could get all of his lower court judges approved within the space of a couple months. The Republicans are like afraid to test the rules, and they're in the majority. And Ted Cruz, I think, has actually been very responsible on this, as is Mike Lee. They talked to the parliamentarian. The parliamentarian was not so negative about the ability to make some changes, like in the what's got to be covered in the mandates, as not having budgetary impact. They said, of course it has budgetary impact. If that's the case, the Republicans have much more freedom to create a bill that they want to create, and the Senate's probably the right place to do it. The House is at war with itself right now. So I agree with you. Pass it. Move it on to the Senate. Republicans there, I think, will be rational and understand that, you know, they get one shot at this apple, and if they don't, then Obamacare will become Obamacare blamed on Trump because he couldn't improve it. So, and I don't think the Democrats are going to come to the table and say, okay, let's now do something bipartisan. Believe me, Republicans would revolt if that's the case. So I agree with you. Politically, they need to get this to the Senate to at least keep the process alive and get the more definitive information about what is allowed in the bill and what's not, and what they can pass with 51 votes, and then do the best they can. And, you know, I think some of it has to do with... Go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish, because I was going to say something.
Go ahead and finish your point. On Medicaid, I think they've done a really good job. You know, the block grants lock in essentially, a payment rate per person or a total dollar amount to the state and gives them flexibility to design programs. Right now, Medicaid's out of control. It's the fastest growing component in the federal budget. It doesn't have quality care. More than half the doctors in the country won't enroll a new Medicaid patient. So let the states experiment like they did with welfare reform. That turned out well, I think, in the 1990s when Clinton and Gingrich, you know, reached their own compromise. So that's a good idea. The real problems on this have to do with the exchanges, which is what do you do to make policies lower cost and give subsidies to the right people? Those are the two issues. And it's not rocket science. They can work that out. I mean, they have smart people. They have numbers people to assist them. They should be able to do it.
Well, the other thing, too, is that I think one of the reasons that I want this to go to the Senate is because I'd rather have Ted Cruz explain it, not because he's my senator, but I'd rather have Ted Cruz explain it than some of the people in the House who, frankly, are not as good as Ted Cruz is in explaining something like this. Now, something else, we're going to take a little break and then come back to talk about the other stories. But one, something else I wanted to say about healthcare is that I was listening to the radio to Rush Limbaugh about an hour ago, and he was saying that the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I guess Dr. Price in this case, actually has a lot of discretion on how to do away with Obamacare, that a lot of the things that Obamacare created were done by the discretion of the whoever the secretary was under his presidency, and that a lot of this can actually be deleted by simply the discretion of the secretary. So many of the things that people are afraid of continuing could actually be done away by the secretary without having to even go to the Senate. That's what I understand. I could be wrong, Richard.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Some of the conservatives don't like that approach because their concern is if the changes aren't in the law, then the next time a Democrat gets elected president, which could be in 2020, their Secretary of Health will simply change the rules again and get them back to where they were. So they would prefer that all the changes be permanent and require both legislation and the president agreeing. And that makes sense to some extent because given, you know, demographic changes in the country, given the all-out assault on Trump, you wonder about, you know, whether Republicans are going to win the next presidential election.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. But it's just fascinating. I just hope it comes through today so that we can actually have a happy moment, if even only symbolically, later this afternoon. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with our friend Richard right after this.
This is Carlos Quedes, Harpist, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
It's my good friend Carlos. We've played his music a lot on our show over the last couple of years. He's originally from Venezuela, and he's performing here in Dallas at NOLA. So if you're, you know, if you got nothing to do on Saturday night, you want to go out for a nice meal and listen to some good music, go to NOLA, N-O-L-A, in downtown Dallas, and you're going to get some good music as well as some good food. Let's get back to our friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at the American Thinker. I wanted to say something about American Thinker. It's amazing how much American Thinker is now, how well regarded and how many people check it out. I was talking to someone the other day that I hadn't seen since high school, and I said, well, gee, thanks for, how did you find me? He said, well, I saw an article that you wrote at American Thinker. And I said, well,
yeah,
thank you. That's great.
I bet people from high school get in touch with me because they read something I wrote on the site.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. So I congratulate you and Tom and everybody at the site. You guys are doing a fabulous job. Let's talk about some of the other big stories. I guess one has to be the Gorsuch Supreme Court hearings, which, is it unfair to say, or am I too partisan when I say that the Democrats made fools of themselves? Because I've never seen anything so silly as Al Franken arguing with a real judge about the meaning of a case. I mean, that's almost ridiculous. Yeah. If I was a Democrat, I wouldn't even put him in. Yeah, I wouldn't even allow him to ask questions, Richard.
Yeah, or Amy Klobuchar, who's, I think, Yale Law School or Harvard Law School, making 10 minutes of questions about he and she and whether he is inclusive enough in some of the opinions that have been written, as if somehow that's an indicative of hatred or disparagement or discrimination against women. I think the Gorsuch did well. People say he comes out of central casting, but he's moderate. He has a nice temperament and disposition. And he's learned the rules, which were really established when Ginsburg and others were nominated and went through their hearings in the 90s. After the Bork hearings, everybody decided you just can't tell anybody what you think about any issue, and you use the excuse that this is a live topic that might come before you, and you have to look at the facts and circumstances. So the most that these guys will say will be something about whether they regard something as a precedent. And precedents have to be examined. You know, sometimes, of course, they're also overruled. But I thought he did fine, and it's pretty grueling. You know, I do expert witness testimony for a living, and when you're on the stand, you know, for 10 or 11 hours, and half the time someone is trying to trip you up, and to some extent just it's a kabuki dance to please, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party so the senators can make it appear that they're standing firm against this out-of-the-mainstream conservative, you know, who will take us back to back-alley abortions and gays in the closet and America without birth control and discrimination like Jim Crow. I mean, this is the thing that the base believes about any Republican and any Republican nominee to the court. And so these guys have to push all of the gender and racial themes to try to score points. And I was really disappointed when I read that Bob Casey, one of the few pro-life Democrats in Congress, who was a senator from Pennsylvania and was up for re-election in 2018 in a state Trump won, announced that he wasn't going to back Gorsuch. And that told me if you can't get a guy like Casey, who is not a left-wing crazy, the pressure on these guys from their own base must be so extreme that if they cave and vote for a Republican nominee, especially after what Republicans did to Merrick Garland, that they're going to get primaried and they'll find somebody to the left and they'll take him down and everybody will be punished if they don't toe the line. So that's what the Democratic Party is right now. They are the party of no. They're committed to bringing Trump down. They will mention Russia every morning, noon, and night. You know, the guys in the New York Times now writing columns about Trump committed treason. I mean, it's almost off the deep end, but it's what appeals to an extremely angry base of the Democratic Party, which may be a third of the country. And you see them when they show up in congressional offices. They're simply not going to be placated. They don't have open minds. They cannot see the wisdom of approving someone who's obviously highly qualified and was judged as such by the American Bar Association, because he's not picked by a Democratic president.
Yeah, but it seems to me, though, that this is what, and I remember posting something on American Thinker about this the other day, but this is what the Senate was created so that you wouldn't have people making mm-hmm. decisions based on all these popular passions. That's
right.
What the House is for. But the Senate was created so that you would have people who could stand back and say, yeah, this guy was elected by Trump, but he's qualified. Let's put him in.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Senate
mm-hmm.
becomes nothing more than just a smaller version of the House elected every 6 years, then what is the point of having a 60-vote rule? I mean, it's just going to be a way of keeping a partisan minority from letting anything come to a vote. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I think we may have reached the point where let's just go with 51 votes, and if they want to scream, let them scream. And if when they run the place and they can do it, which they did already anyway, so what's the point of traditions that the other side isn't going to respect? But you were talking about Russia and treason. I find it fascinating. Nobody wrote about treason when President Obama said to the fellow from Russia that if he got reelected, he would have more options or something or more freedom. I mean, nobody talked about treason back then, but I thought that was a pretty amazing remark.
I wrote a couple articles for American Thinker effectively arguing that sometimes I thought Obama was playing for the other team. I mean, when you look at how obsessed he was with getting this Iran deal through, which he was pushing really for 7 years, 30 Democratic senators met with the Russian ambassador to discuss the Iran deal, you know, before it was finally approved and negotiated. And so you got to ask yourself, who was this the beneficiary of that deal? Democratic senators, who were they working for? Russia?
The United States?
Iran? Syria?
Well, yeah, you're right. And then you have a situation where, because of that 60-vote rule, the Senate was not even allowed to vote on something like the Iran deal. I mean, the Iran deal basically got lost in the Senate because of the 60-vote rule. So the president of the United States was able to implement a deal that was never put through as a treaty as it should have been and never even got a vote in the U.S. Senate. I mean, I don't think that's what the 60-vote rule was supposed to do. I thought it was supposed to bring people together. But as partisan as the Senate is right now, I don't know that anything can bring these people together. One quick point here I wanted to get your thoughts on. All these allegations by Representative Nunes, and then you have the response by Representative Schiff. It looks like excuse me for a second there. It looks like this. It looks crazy to me, sitting out here in Texas looking at all of this. It's almost like I don't know what to believe anymore, Richard. So what do you believe about these allegations by Representative Nunes and Representative Shiva? What are you hearing from all of this?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing is I don't have a lot of regard for Schiff after the way he attacked people trying to interview the families and people involved in Benghazi in 2012. He launched a protection racket for President Obama in that matter. But as far as what's going on now, again, there's two things going on. One is the attempt to make Trump look illegitimate by arguing that his people were in collusion with the Russians to help change the outcome of the election. And personally, if you can find someone in America who voted for Trump and not Clinton because of the WikiLeaks releases or John Podesta's emails or the Democratic National Committee emails, I haven't found one. I don't know anyone who voted for Trump and not Clinton because of anything they may have read in any of those two things. So the idea that was involved seems nuts. To me, the Russians were involved in trying to screw up the election, and they do that all over the world. You know, this is not something new for them. They, like everybody else, thought Clinton was going to win. So what was their real objective? The real objective was to make Clinton's White House more troubled, put her in more trouble by weakening her before she took office so that she would be a damaged president and less able to mount an offensive against them. That's what I think was going on in terms of why the Russians got to intervene here. I don't think they had any love for Trump. He doesn't have any business dealings there, despite all the attempts to smear him for them. But what's going on with Nunes is interesting because, in a sense, he is arguing that there was surveillance, not wiretapping of Trump's individual phone, but there was surveillance and stuff was going on at Trump Tower during the months of the transition with people on his team and people they were interviewing. And it's not clear how much of it was between someone on Trump's team and someone from a foreign country, which is why a wiretap, the FISA approval was needed, or whether it was between two foreigners and they were talking about Trump. The problem is that when there's legal surveillance occurring, you protect the Americans who are named incidentally in the communication when it's delivered to other agencies or other people in government. That wasn't done, apparently, in some cases here. It was clear who the American was that they were talking about or who the American was that was part of a conversation. And apparently this was spread widely. And we know that Obama had a huge distribution in the months, in the week, really, before he left office to make sure this Russia stuff kept going, that they spread whatever information they had about the involvement themselves. So this story is more than just whatever Russia did, which, you know, should be investigated because they tried to interfere with our election. There's something going on here with a sitting president was trying, I think, to set up the new president to fail, and also not observing the established law of the land in terms of protecting privacy. So,
right. Not just a couple thing. Of thoughts on that. No, I agree with you, and I'm glad that you explained it the way you did because it clarifies some of the doubts that I had. But I just a couple of things. One about Representative Schiff. I saw him for a bit this morning between meetings, and he was very concerned about the way that I guess this has to do with the allegations that the British were intervening or participating. And Adam Schiff was very concerned about what we were doing to our oldest ally, which kind of reminded me of that Winston Churchill bust that was apparently removed. I don't remember any Democrat saying that we were upsetting our oldest ally.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory, too, and it's just a theory, but it's a gut feeling theory, whatever. I think that since they thought they were going to win so badly, they really thought they were going to win, that they got sloppy. They got sloppy in their – I mean, I'm talking about the Obama administration. They got sloppy. They thought, we're going to win, and Hillary's going to win, and she's going to protect us. Nothing's going to come out. Look, nothing happened with the IRS and Benghazi and Fast and Furious because had people in place to protect us. Yeah, nothing happened, basically. And they thought the same thing will happen. We'll do these little tricks on Trump, And then after the election, Hillary will protect us and we'll get away with
right.
it. I think
exactly.
that's what's really going on,
right.
that they panicked.
Yep.
And
yep.
now
no,
they're
right.
perhaps dealing with the consequences. You know, it kind of reminds me of the story of the teenage kid who wasn't supposed to drive his dad's car. And
mm-hmm.
He did. And then he got caught because he got into an accident or whatever. And that wasn't supposed to happen. But anyway, it's kind of weird. But I think that's somewhere in this
yep.
mix, I think, is the
mm-hmm.
thing that they thought they were going to win and they
yep.
didn't win. So now they have all this house cleaning
to
do.
They were arrogant. They were always
yes.
arrogant. I mean, does anyone want to suggest really that the Obama team didn't know about what the IRS was doing and that the Obama team didn't signal, the White House didn't signal to the IRS to do what it was doing, that somehow that decision was made at lower levels of the organization and that's where the ideologues were? There's no way. There's no way.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Well, as always, thank you so much for your time, and it's always a great honor to have you on the show and to hear your thoughts on all of this. I've been fighting with allergies, as you can tell, so I'm struggling with my voice from time to time.
I'm usually the one coughing on your show, so you're just
catching
up.
Well, this
up.
Time I'm the one who's – yeah, well, this time you're doing better than me because this time I'm the one who's struggling with allergies. But I want to thank you for your time as always, and thanks to you and all your friends at American Thinker, and hopefully we can do this again very soon.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Sylvia. Have a good weekend.
Thank you so much. Our friend Richard Baer of American Thinker, it's always a great pleasure to have him on the show and to talk about the important issues of the day. As I said, you can read Richard not just in American Thinker, but he writes in many other places, and he writes a lot about national security issues and political issues. And right now, it would be to your advantage to read a lot of the things that he's writing, particularly with respect to the Middle East. I think I've learned a great deal just by reading what he writes. Well, we're going to get a lot of rain. We're already getting a lot of rain here in Dallas, and hopefully it'll end soon so we can go out and not have to put up with all these traffic problems that happen around here when it rains. Have a wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.